principles that don't require specification, specific about the nature of the specific transformations involved, such as, for example, Einstein's version of the principle of relativity or the Einstein-Galilean principle, that don't specify the nature of the coordinate transformations associated with boosts, as opposed to group theoretical symmetries where the specification has to be made as to how the what the transformations are. So if we take the second class of symmetries, we can distinguish between global symmetries and local symmetries. So the group of symmetry transformation, which is now specified, will either depend on a set of constant parameters, say n independent parameters, or a set of functions of space and time. So what we're interested in today, and this is the subject of notice for his theorem, are those symmetries that are related to constant parameters. Now, just to fix ideas, suppose we just consider doing a transformation, a translation in space. Now, this is going to be determined by some vector, some three vector. Each of its components considered independent, so we have to specify three parameters to specify the translation in space. But of course, that translation in space corresponds to the, let's say, the act of shift of the origin of our coordinate system. That transformation doesn't depend on space and time. It just depends on three constant quantities, which are the three components, the three vectors that characterize the translation in space. And similarly with boosts and rotations, the global phase transformation in quantum mechanics and so on. And that's what we're looking at today, those kinds of global transformations, depending on constant parameters. Now, recently in the philosophical literature, there's been something of a discussion about the meaning of Noether's first theorem. Now, you'll remember, Noether's first theorem establishes some sort of connection between dynamical symmetries associated with these global transformations and conservation principles. And the question is, how does the error, the explanatory error, go? What might be called the traditional approach. Now, Bas van Frassen, a very prominent philosopher of science, wrote a book in 1989, Laws and Symmetry, in which he claimed that in the 20th century, we have learned to say that every symmetry yields a conservation law. Another part of the book, he says, symmetries engender conservation laws. Incidentally, we're going to see in a moment, of course, that this is strictly not true in the sense that not every dynamical symmetry is a Noether symmetry. This is a very important point. Not every symmetry of certain equations of motion governing some dynamical system is also going to be a variational symmetry. That's to say, a variational symmetry with respect to the action. Plenty of counterexamples. If you don't have a variational symmetry, it's not a Noether symmetry, which means you can't set up a Noether theorem. So it's certainly not the case that every symmetry has some connection with a conservation law. We'll see examples later on. But the idea here is somehow that the explanatory arrow goes from symmetries to conservation principles. Now, Landau and Lipschitz, in one of their books, claims that there are some quantities whose constancy with respect to time is of profound significance, and it derives from the fundamental homogeneity and isotropy of space and time. So, coming back to the to the homogeneity of space, for example, well, the homogeneity of space is simply the claim that the fundamental laws of motion for a dynamical system are covariant or form invariant under a transformation of the coordinates that corresponds to a translation of space, a rigid translation of space. Similarly, the homogeneity of time, the equations of motion or field equations, whatever a dynamical system is, those equations will be covariant under a translation along the time axis. Isotropy of space and time, well, the isotropy of space, of course, is associated with rotations of the coordinate system. Each one of these cases in general, that's to say, each one of these cases leads to a conservation principle, and you won't be surprised to hear that the homogeneity of space yields the conservation of linear momentum. The homogeneity of time yields the conservation of energy. Normally, we'll see counterexamples. And of course, the isotropy of space under ordinary circumstances yields conservation of angular momentum. So the idea here is essentially, I would say this is the traditional idea. There's any number of textbooks where you can see the symmetry being a starting point, and as it were, it's explaining the conservation principle. But there's a nice quotation here from John Byers in 2002, where he says, Noether's theorem is an amazing result. It lets physicists get conserved quantities from symmetries of the laws of nature. And the question here is, what do we mean by get? So there is a slightly revisionist point of view, if that's not too melodramatic a term, which says basically there isn't an explanatory error in Noether. The Noether theorem establishes a correlation between symmetries and conservation principles. Neither one is more fundamental from an explanatory point of view than the other. So really, it's sort of a defensive position that I want to go through today, but we'll look at some specific examples. But of course, if you make the claim that intrinsic to the theory, to the theorem, Noether's theorem, there isn't an explanatory error, then one has to explain why it is that so often symmetries are put first. Why is this the case?
Yeah, when you mean symmetry, you mean symmetry of a dynamical system. But by a dynamical system, you don't need just an equation of motion. Because in general, that's not true. That's the theorem is not true. If you just have you can have that, some equations of motion, or some electrical equation, which has a symmetry.
Right.
But the fact that the constant quantity is, the fact that, usually these equations are, there's something behind these equations, which is this symplectic structure, which usually don't spell out, which is something behind.
I'll come back to that.
Okay.
Yeah, but even in the book,
even
before the boundary condition.
Even before the boundary, Noether's theorem will give you a continuity. Whether the continuity equation gives you a conserved quantity depends on boundary conditions. And they're at times non-trivial. But the issue here, I think that Laurent is pointing out, is that a symmetry, let's call it dynamical symmetry. A dynamical symmetry is a set of transformations, it's a group of transformations of variables that appear in the equations of motion or the field equations that preserve the form of the equations themselves. So let's say the Euler-Lagrange equations. That's a dynamical symmetry. Not every dynamical symmetry is a Noether symmetry. Maybe that's the point that Laurent was pointing to. They're very easy to find counterexamples. Scaling, for example, is a very common case. You can scale your parameters by, say, a constant amount. The equations of motion, if they contain nothing but derivatives, of course, the scale doesn't matter. So a scaling, for example, many equations of motion are covariant under scaling or rescalings, but the action may not be invariant under scaling. So that's not a Noether symmetry. And there's no corresponding conserved quantity or even continuity equation. But I'll go through this in some detail in a moment. So I'm just warning you that there is a sermon at the end of this lecture. But the sermon has to do with the question of explanatory error. Nonetheless, we still have to make sense of the fact that physics textbooks, generally speaking, start with symmetries rather than conserved quantities. Okay. I'm sure that this little exercise in the calculus of variations is very, very well known to you, so I'll go through it very quickly. But what I want to do in this slide is distinguish Noether's variational problem from Hamilton's variational problem. They're two quite different things. So let's start with a Lagrangian density. We have an action that's the integral of a Lagrangian density. And I'm going to assume that the Lagrangian density depends on a set of fields, phi i. These are not necessarily scalar fields. They could be the components of, say, tensorial objects more generally. And I could assume, for the sake of argument, just well, basically for the sake of simplicity, that, and as normally this is done in the literature, that the Lagrangian density depends on the fields and their first derivatives with respect to the spatial components of space-time, the first derivatives. But nothing hangs on this. This is just for simplicity. You can always do the inertial variational problem if you have higher derivatives in the Lagrangian density. And what we're interested in is variations, simultaneous variations, both in the coordinates, continuous variations in coordinates and in the fields. We're interested in infinitesimal transformations, and already we're departing from the Hamilton variational problem, the thing that we normally use to derive the stationarity principle to derive the Euler Lagrange equations, because in Hamilton's principle, we don't vary the coordinates, spatial coordinates. We vary the fields. Now, I'm assuming here, remember I mentioned that these transformations are going to depend on certain parameters, some set of, say, n independently chosen global parameters, that's to say, space-time independent parameters. And this first term here in the variation, I'm assuming that it's linear in these parameters. So if we're looking at infinitesimal transformations, we're not interested in the higher in the higher order terms. We're just really interested in the first order terms. So I'm assuming that these variations here, in both the coordinates and the fields, are linear in these relevant parameters. And I'll come back to the parameters in a moment. Ordinarily, of course, when we introduce a variation in the coordinates, we automatically induce a variation in the fields because these objects are usually defined by their transformation properties, such as tensors. Tensors themselves are defined by how they transform under arbitrary coordinate transformations. But the thing that I want to stress here is the difference between the Hamilton principle and the Noether variational principle is the following. With Hamilton, we choose an arbitrary variation of the fields, infinitesimal variation of fields, and no variation of the coordinates. With Noether, we specify a Lie group, a specific Lie group of the coordinate variations, coordinate transformations, and the corresponding induced variations in the fields. So it's specific and not general. It's not universal. Now, we now define in the usual way the variation in the action. We're only interested in the first order variation, that's to say, the variation that only depends on the variations in the coordinates in the fields that are linear in these particular infinitesimal parameters of interest. And this is the way we normally define the variation. We take the same functional form of the action and simply write its arguments in the transformed case, and we look at the resulting action, and we subtract from that the original action. That's exactly what we do in Hamilton's principle, is the first variation. And now the question is, what kind of imposition is there on the dynamics if we say that that variation is either zero, which is what Noether said, or simply a surface term, in other words, the integral of a total divergence? And why am I introducing an integral to total divergence when Noether didn't? Well, Noether was aware that in her original paper that you could generalize her condition from ds is equal to zero, that's to say the first variation is equal to zero, to this case here. And why are we introducing this? You will all be aware that when you specify Lagrangian density in physics, the government that's supposed to determine the behavior of some dynamical system, it's only defined, strictly speaking, up to a four divergence. Because if you add a four divergence to Lagrangian density, the equations of motion, the Euler Lagrange equations, are not effective. And this is really why this thing appears here. It's a bit of a roundabout argument, but if you're unhappy with this, well, I will give examples afterwards where you have to allow for this divergence term. But Noether's original condition was that the ds was zero. But we're allowing for this more general case because this is reflecting the fact that the Lagrangian itself is not defined, well, it's only defined up to a total divergence. So far, so good. Now, the question that I want to raise at this point is, what we've, I call this a variational quasi-invariant. It's quasi-invariant because ds not equal to zero, but it has this possible surface term, it could be a surface term, through Gauss's theorem. What has this got to do with the dynamical symmetry? It's interesting that Noether herself, in her 1980 paper, never used the word symmetry. Is this famous paper that's supposed to relate symmetries to conservation principles, and Noether never says the word symmetry. And in particular, the question that I'm asking here is, just because this action satisfies a certain variational quasi-invariance condition, what does that have to do with these things being what I referred to before as dynamical symmetries? How do you know a priori that these transformations will also be symmetries in the relative sense of the Euler-Lagrange equations? I'm going to leave this question open for the moment. But ordinarily, it is the case that if this quasi-invariance condition holds, then that symmetry will be a dynamical symmetry of the equations of motion. Now, I don't know what your philosophy is about the action principle. Some people claim that the action itself has some kind of deep physical significance. Some other people claim it's only a means to an end. And in particular, it's very, very important in physics. Well, why is it important in physics? Why do we use action principles? Well, there are various reasons. One of them, it turns out, will end up being noticed. That's one of the reasons we use an action. I'll say why later on. It's really because of Noether. Another, of course, is because of canonical quantization. But I think all of you would probably agree that when it comes to the meat of physics, when it comes to the crunch, the real physics is in the Euler-Lagrange equations. That's what we test in the laboratory. Has anybody ever bumped into one of these? And by the way, do they have to be scalar invariants? For example, in GR and some textbooks, you often come across the claim, well, for this thing to be anything like physical, it must be a scalar invariant. It must be a number that's well-defined as, you know, this must be a number that can't depend on the coordinate system, so it must be diffeomorphically invariant. Don't forget, this thing here is only defined up to total divergence. So you can take the Einstein-Hilbert action, which is a scalar invariant, and you can add a divergence term, which will give you something that's not a scalar invariant, and that's just the Einstein-gamma-gamma action. That's not a scalar invariant, but still gives you the same field equations. So again, I'm just stressing the fact that there's a certain degree of ambiguity in the very definition of the action, and that's reflected in this quasi-invariance condition. So I'm just highlighting the fact that if one wants to understand Noether's theorem fully, one wants to have a story. And for example, Alba's recent book on Lie groups gives a very nice account of this. But there is one condition that I'll come back to later. Well, I might as well say it now. I think it's the case that it's a necessary condition for this to go through, for there to be a connection between a a variational invariance and a dynamical symmetry, or perhaps putting it slightly differently, a variational symmetry and a dynamical symmetry. It's required that all the fields satisfy Hamilton's principle. In other words, all the fields are dynamical. If not all the fields are dynamical, not all the fields satisfy Hamilton's principle, you can find counterexamples. They're rather artificial, but there are counterexamples to the claim that a Noether symmetry is automatically a dynamical symmetry. I'm just flagging that.
Suppose I make a variation of the field which is proportional to the equations of motion. Right. Proportional to delta S, in some sense, isn't that a weird example where
do you mean it's proportional to the Euler
yeah.
function, which would be zero if the equations of motion were true?
Well, let me try to find.
No, I don't think that is a symmetry.
If I have several fields, I can symmetrize. There's something which you can cook up something which is weird, which is Just something like on shell doesn't change anything, but the action is environment of that. But you're saying,
That's a dynamical symmetry that's not a notice. I think that's how it works. That's a dynamical symmetry, but not because it only works on shell. But I'm thinking of the other way around. I'm saying, suppose you're given inertial symmetry. How do you know automatically? How do you know that it's always dynamical symmetry? So I'm inverting the question. And I'm saying it isn't always. One of the necessary conditions, and I think this is the case, that if you want to prove that inertial symmetry is a dynamical symmetry, you need the claim that all of the fields are dynamical. They all satisfy Hamilton's principle. And that's not logically necessary. We'll see a counterexample in a moment. Maybe we can come back to this.
But beyond, you mentioned something, it's related to the question I asked. It's true that in physics, any dynamical equation we have or so far comes from a Lagrange principle.
And the interesting point.
Yeah, there's no reason for that, right?
We have plenty of counterexamples, except that they're not always very interesting.
Like fluid dynamics or any fundamental equation.
It turns out that all the fundamental equations in physics do have a Lagrangian structure or a Lagrangian origin. But that's a strange. I mean, we don't really understand this. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's easy to find equations of motion that don't have a Lagrange. Yeah. And then you might ask yourself, how would you quantize those? You simply can't use the methods of canonical quantization. There's a nice paper that I came across recently. No Lagrange, the type of no Lagrangian, no quantization.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean?
That's just some crazy, algebraic properties here with the old like action.
No, in general.
So you just start with some, some operating part.
I mean, maybe one of the things that I'll try to bring up later is.
There's a quantization somewhere, there's a symplectic structure, right. And there's a symplectic structure that's kind of an action, right? So.
If you don't have Lagrangian formulas, you pay a price, not just because of the difficulty of quantization, there's another price. Again, this has to do with notice, but I'll come back to this.
Yeah.
Well, the quasi invariants, if you just work through, you do the usual integration by parts, I'm sure all of you are familiar with this, because you're familiar with Hamilton's principle. You end up, if you impose this quasi-invariance condition, you end up with a linear combination of the Euler expressions associated with each field. Notice that I'm summing over the fields here. These are indices that represent the different fields, but I'm using the Einstein summation convention for the mu's, which are associated, of course, with the coordinate indices. So there's a linear combination. Remember, the Euler expressions are just, as it were, the left-hand side of the Euler-Lagrange equations. If these things are equal to zero, those are the Euler-Lagrange equations, and that's the result of applying Hamilton's principle with respect to the variation of the field in question. So this really, as it were, is the field equation without the equal zeros. So we have a linear combination of these Euler expressions where the coefficients are not the variations in the fields, which I defined earlier, they're the so-called form variations, or the Lie drags. In other words, they're the difference in the values of the fields before and after the transformation at a given point in space-time. Whereas we defined the variations before as phi prime x prime minus phi x prime. So these are sometimes called the form variations. I'm sure, again, you're familiar with this through the calculus of variations. Now, so we have this linear combination of the Euler expressions, and that's going to be equal to a total divergence of something. And the total divergence, and again, I'm sure this is familiar to you, as a term that depends on the derivative of the Lagrangian density with respect to the first derivatives of the fields. Here we have the Lie drags of the fields themselves as coefficients of this term. Here's the term that represents the variation in the coordinates. And this is the term that represents that surface term that was defined in the quasi-invariance principle. So let's call this the Noether condition. So we're almost there. We're already beginning to see how a continuity equation might arise. Because if for some reason we can convince ourselves the left-hand side is zero, then we have the four divergence, the total divergence of some quantity is equal to zero. That's a continuity equation. Anyone like to say why the left-hand side should be zero? Why should the left-hand side? Remember, this is a linear combination of our Euler expressions. So why should the left-hand side be equal to zero? Because the equations of motion are true. But just one thing that I'll come back to. That's not necessary. It's sufficient. Because, of course, if we apply Hamilton's principle to every one of these fields, phi I, then, of course, and we vary the action with respect to arbitrary variations with respect to in phi I, then, of course, the Euler expression will vanish. That's just Hamilton's principle, and therefore that linear combination will vanish. But suppose, for the sake of argument, all of these except one vanished. We were left with one term where the Euler expression didn't vanish because it's not a dynamical field. Think of G mu nu when you've got a fixed background space-time. Okay, you're not going to apply Hamilton's principle to G mu nu, variations of G mu nu, because it's an absolute background space-time. But if you have killing vectors, the killing vectors ensure, under certain circumstances, the right killing vectors will ensure that the form variation in G mu nu is zero. So if you have a killing vector, even though the Euler expression associated with G mu nu doesn't vanish, that last term will vanish, and you'll still get a continuity equation. So the strict vanishing of all the Euler expressions is sufficient but not necessary for the Noether theorem to give rise to a continuity equation. Okay, well, just to finish the discussion of the theorem, I mentioned before that these first variations in the coordinates and the fields can be represented as they're linear. Now, the omega k are these parameters that are independently specified. In the case of a spatial translation, for example, there are three components of this three vector that determines the spatial translation. So k will be an index that runs between, say, 1 and n. N just means the number of these independent parameters I need to specify in order to define my Lie group. Now, I should have mentioned before that Noether condition that we had before resulted from how did we go from an integral to a non-integral equation? Well, because the variational condition was stated independently of the domain of integration. So if it holds for all the possible domains of integration, then the integrands themselves come out. And now we're assuming that all of these omega k's, these things that determine the Lie group, the parameterized Lie group, are independent. So we can write down equations for each one of them. So now we rewrite the Noether condition, but now in terms of the coefficients of our parameters and these linear combinations, and this is how we write down the Noether condition. So once again, we have a linear combination of the Euler expressions. On the right-hand side, we have the total divergence of some four-current, and the four-current takes this form. So I'm just rewriting the Noether condition, now using the specific form of the coefficients of these linear combinations of parameters. As I said before, if the left-hand side vanishes, and it's a sufficient condition is that all the fields are dynamical, then we end up getting a continuity equation. And now the point that was raised before about the boundary conditions comes in. If we can write this, if we take the spatial integral of this equation, we can write this as d by dt of the spatial integral of the zeroth component. Remember, there's an equation, a continuity equation for each one of these parameters. So for each one of these k's, there's going to be a continuity equation. This will be equal to the spatial derivative of a three divergent, and then Gauss's theorem tells us we're going to get a surface term. And if the fields themselves fall off sufficiently fast with distance, in other words, we impose certain boundary conditions, through Gauss's theorem, that surface integral will vanish if we have a big enough region of integration, and we end up just getting the d by dt of this thing is equal to zero, so we can define an inert charge. So the north component of this four current will be our inert charge, and we get something that's conserved. But again, I just stress, it's important that the fields have the correct boundary conditions, otherwise we won't be able to break out of the continuity equation. So it's probably better to think in general of the Noether theorem as really being about a continuity equation rather than a conservation principle. But in many, many cases, interesting cases, the conservation principle also holds. Now, I was going to go through some specific examples. I can do this if there's time. Let's say I wanted to remind you that today we have to stop early because we have another meeting at 1 o'clock with the Institute. So I should stop soon after 12 or around 12. And another thing I should mention before I forget is that I'm going to be mentioning, at least very briefly, some recent applications of Noether's first theorem. It's also the case that Noether's first theorem in the case of quantum field theory becomes extremely, extremely complicated. It's a very, very much more, it's an order of magnitude more difficult than quantum field theory. And we have an expert on this subject here at PI, Achille Arzani. If I pronounced it correctly, Arzano, Achille Arzano. And Michele has agreed to speak to us next week briefly about applications of Noether's first theorem in quantum field theory. And in particular, he's been working on the application of Noether's first theorem in doubly special relativity. So I'm hoping he can give us a sort of an update on the very recent, very, very non-trivial applications of Noether's first theorem in quantum field theory. Well, rather than go through the technical details of this recent application, maybe I could just briefly mention something that's rather amusing. If we think of just something very, very simple, like the Schrodinger equation for the free particle, the single particle in quantum mechanics. So we have IH bar. That's a continuity equation. Because we have a dt here, and we have divergence there. Divergence of some free vector. Shouldn't there be a corresponding symmetry? We know that we can get this from an action principle. It's a straightforward action principle that can be either written in terms of psi and psi star, where psi star is a complex conjugate, or in terms of real and imaginary parts. So we can write down a Lagrangian in terms of these real number fields. And again, we end up getting this by varying with respect to these two fields. Does anyone know what the corresponding symmetry is? The corresponding symmetry is very simple. It's psi r goes to psi r prime. Well, that's a real number field, which is constant, which is a constant number. Psi I goes to psi I prime. Psi I goes to psi I. So if you like, what we're really doing is just saying psi goes to psi prime. Psi is epsilon. Constant complex number, which is equal to epsilon r plus I times epsilon I. Now, you might say, but wait a sec. That's not going to preserve the normalization of the wave function. So you're not transforming a state into a state. And Noether's reply would be it doesn't matter. This is a perfectly good continuous infinitesimal transformation of the wave function. Doesn't it take a state into a state? And if you actually apply that symmetry to the Lagrangian, and you go through the Noether theorem, this equation pops out as your equation of continuity. So this is an interesting case where the equations of motion themselves take a form of a continuity equation. Of course, there's the corresponding symmetry. The corresponding symmetry looks rather unfamiliar. Question, what is the associated conserved quantity in this particular case? What is the associated conserved quantity? Well, it turns out that if the gradient of psi falls off sufficiently fast with distance, so again, we're imposing a very non-trivial boundary condition, and if it turns out that we look at a subclass of all the square integral wave functions, such that the integral of the wave function over the whole of space is finite, then it turns out that d by dt, the integral psi dx, zero. Not psi squared dx, psi. Now, of course, there are a number of conditions that go into establishing that continuity, that conservation principle. It's a rather unexpected conservation principle, because this is not the conservation of probability. It's the conservation of the probability amplitude. Well, the integral over the whole of space. But it's a very unfamiliar object. And I like to think of it, maybe this would pose something of a challenge, I don't know how profound, depends on what you think, to people who believe that the wave function is pure information. If the wave function is pure information, of course the following problem arises. If you're not prodding a system, a particular slogan I've heard here at the perimeter on a number of occasions is something like the following. Quantum mechanics is the theory of what happens when you prod a system. It gives back information and its reaction to the prodding process, and that information is encoded in the wave function. But what happens when you're not prodding the system? Well, the system evolves according to the time independent Schrodinger equation. It's a very non-trivial equation. Amongst other things, it violates Galileo's principle that inertial motion is independent of mass, because the spreading of the wave packet for a free particle in quantum mechanics depends on the mass. This is a very strange feature. Very non-trivial. So when you're not prodding a system, the system is all by itself changing in a very non-trivial way. And it's doing so such that for certain solutions of the equation, the integral over the whole of space of the wave function is preserved over time. And why should that be if it's just information?
What is a simple system that you do the integral? What does it give in simple systems? What is the meaning of this?
I don't know.
What you could do also is take suppose your wave function is analytic, so then you can take a closed contour in complex space, and then it has no boundary, so this guy would be a conserved quantity. In that case, this quantity might count the number of nodes of the wave function, something like that. Mm-hmm. It does it more physically.
And I just wanted to mention, putting aside that little bit of perhaps unnecessary polemics, I should also mention that if you look at, for example, Maxwell's equations, the free field, just think of Maxwell's equations. That's also a continuity equation. What's the corresponding symmetry? We know what the Lagrangian density for that field is. It's just f mu. What's the corresponding nervous symmetry? Well, it turns out that it's a mu goes to the four potential. It's just adding a constant vector covector field. That's not a gauge transformation. So it's an unusual transformation, but it's a perfectly consistent, continuous, infinitesimal transformation on the potentials. And when you work through Noether's theorem, you end up getting d mu. J mu is equal to zero, so you have a four current for each nu, and it turns out that J mu is just proportional to f mu. What's the conserved quantity? Well, you probably already know what it is, because if you take one of Maxwell's equations that's associated with, of course, this is only two of Maxwell's equations. If you take dE by dt plus curl of B, and you integrate over the whole space, you can turn this, the spatial integral of this, into a surface term. If B falls off sufficiently fast with distance, then the integral dx. And that's the concern point. Again, but it's very non-trivial that you would impose those boundary conditions. They're not real. You wouldn't expect them to hold for a free field, so it's not entirely clear that this has very much meaning. But again, it's rather amusing to see that the very form of the field equation themselves is a continuity equation, and therefore is maybe an associated measure of symmetry. It's just this thing. So let me just go through some complexities, some complications and subtleties associated with Noether's theorem. Wigner himself pointed out in 1954 in a paper on symmetries that not all dynamical systems are susceptible to Lagrangian formulation. And I think he referred to we must avoid making what he called a facile identification of symmetries and conservation principles, simply because not everything is Lagrange. And this point came up earlier. In particular, for example, if you have a theory with a potential, and the gradient of potential gives rise to velocities, not accelerations, so it's a first-order theory, like the Guidance equations in the Brodermann theory, those equations don't have a Lagrange. And then the other point that we made before was that not all symmetries are Noetherian. That's to say, I mentioned the scaling, for example. If you multiply the wave function by a complex number, because you have derivatives on both sides of the equation, that's not going to change anything. But the Lagrangian is not quasi-invariant under a rescaling. So it's not a Noether symmetry, and it doesn't lead to anything. At least it doesn't lead to anything in the Noether sense. You can't apply Noether's theorem. So not all symmetries are Noetherian, and this is well known. The symmetry may not lead to a continuity equation if not all the fields, for example, are dynamical, or if not all the fields are dynamical and the coefficients on the left-hand side of the Noether condition, well, if not all of the terms on the left-hand side of the Noether condition vanish, the symmetry may not even lead to a continuity equation, let alone a conserved quantity. Even if, in the case where you do have a continuity equation and the left-hand side of the Noether condition, that linear combination of the Euler expressions vanishes, that may not lead to a conserved quantity either, simply because the appropriate boundary conditions may fail. Again, this is something that's very well known. What we've just seen in the case of the Schrodinger equation and in the case of Maxwell, the free field, the continuity equation, well, I shouldn't say trivial, because Maxwell's equations are not trivial. Neither is the free Schrodinger equation. But they may be trivial in the sense that you already started with. You're not picking out a new equation that's different from the equations of motion. In other words, they're just identical to the equations of motion. And the charge itself, the Noether charge, need not be real valued. The Noether symmetry may not carry states into states, which is what we saw here. This transformation doesn't take states into states. It doesn't preserve the normalization of the state. Again, these are just sort of amusing details of the Noether theorem and its various applications. But the thing that I really wanted to stress before I go on is that which symmetry is associated with a given conserved quantity can depend on the choice of the Hamiltonian. Now, why is that? I mentioned before that a Lagrangian density in the case of fields, or a Lagrangian in the case of particle theory, if you're given the form of a Lagrangian and you add a divergence term to that Lagrangian, you're going to get exactly the same equations of motion, and everybody does this. It's like a gauge freedom in the very nature of the Lagrangian itself. But there are other cases where the Lagrangian is ill-defined in a much stronger way. There are cases of what people call inequivalent Lagrangians. There are dynamical systems that have a pair of Lagrangians that are not related by a divergence. And there are some very striking cases in the literature. They're not terribly useful, but they are striking from a logical point of view, and understanding nervous theory. And the point that I wanted to make here was, suppose you have one of these systems in which there are inequivalent Lagrangians. And suppose, now I mentioned before that all of the physics is in the Euler-Lagrange equations. Now the Euler-Lagrange equations will either support a symmetry and a conservation principle, or they won't. Suppose that they're consistent with a conserved quantity. The Euler-Lagrange equations, which are common to both Lagrangians, support some conserved quantity. Question, what's the corresponding symmetry? So if you're explaining conserved quantity on the basis of a symmetry, it's contextual. You have to specify a Lagrangian. If you specify it in these very special cases a different Lagrangian, you're not going to get that symmetry. So this raises a question mark as to whether or not the symmetries really are more fundamental than the conserved quantities already, as it depends on the choice of the Lagrangian. Now, if people want examples of this, I can come back to it. Now, let's put all of these subtleties aside. Let's forget about the fact there are inequivalent Lagrangians. Let's forget about the fact that conservation principles don't always lead, continuity equations don't always lead to conserved quantities, and so on and so forth. Let's just go back to the very basic logic of Noether's theorem. I've said before that we start with a Noether variational symmetry, what we might call a variational symmetry, which means a set of transformations of the variables and the coordinates such that the first variation in the action is zero up to a surface term. In other words, delta S is equal to possibly some interval of a four divergence. Usually, and you'll find a very nice proof of this in Olmo's book on Lie groups, if you have a variational symmetry, you will also have a dynamical symmetry. And they're what we're interested in. We're interested in transformations of variables to preserve the form of the Euler-Lagrange equations. That's where all the physics is. That's where the meat is. So fortunately, we can write an arrow that way. I say usually, because there are these very rather special counterexamples where not all the Lagrangian, not all of the fields, for example, satisfy Hamilton's principle. But generally speaking, we like to think that everything in physics is dynamical. We don't like to have background objects, background structures, absolute structures. So we're not going to worry about those too much. Now, what did Noether's theorem prove? Noether's theorem proved that if you have a variational symmetry, there will also be a continuity equation. Assuming that the left-hand side of the Noether condition vanishes, the linear combination of the Euler expressions vanishes. Let's assume that. But her theorem had an inverse. If you have a conservation principle, and you know what the Lagrangian is, you can find the corresponding symmetry. So I'm putting arrows in both directions here. That's what her theorem proved, this thing here. Now, what we're really interested in is the connection between this guy, these guys, and these guys. Now, we know, as I said before, that usually if we have a variational symmetry, we also have a dynamical symmetry. But all that Noether has established is a correlation between these and these. Noether hasn't established that these are somehow more significant because her theorem has an inverse. And of course, the equations of motion, the Euler-Lagrange equations of motion, are supporting both the symmetries and the conserved quantities. And if you just start with the equations of motion, you can easily prove this. Well, maybe not easily. This is where the physics is, and this is there'll be a structural property of the equations that they have certain symmetries, and a structural property of the equations that they give rise to certain conservation principles. Where is the explanatory arrow? does not go from here to here any more than it goes from here to here. So why then, why is it that in so many textbooks we see conserved quantities being explained or engendered or derived from symmetries? That's the question that I posed at the very beginning. Is this really a misreading of the structure of Noether's theorem? Not really. I mean, I think it's useful to see that in the logic of the very theorem itself, there isn't an explanatory asymmetry. But well, then why is it that we always start with symmetries, right? Because they're easier to spot. It's as simple as that. If you're given a Lagrangian, it's easy to see the symmetries. It's easier to find transformations that preserve the form. I mean, for example, when you write down, the minute you write down the Hilbert action, you can see by inspection that that's diffeomorphic. That's a symmetry. Well, that's not a Noether symmetry in the sense. It's a Noether symmetry of a local. But maybe that's not such a good example. But you can see what I mean. Very often, the action principles carry the symmetries on their sleeves, but not the conserved quantities. You can look at an action until you're blue in the face sometimes, but it's not absolutely clear that you will see something conserved. Right? So I think this is where the asymmetry comes in. Now, why is this? I don't know. But it just seems to be a fact of life. Actions wear symmetries on their sleeves and not conservation. So that explains why in practice we start with the symmetries. We lead them off the actions rather simply in relation to conserved quantities, and then we derive the conserved quantities using the Noether theorem. It's a mechanism. You turn the handle and out will pop the conserved quantities given the appropriate boundary conditions. And I think that's really the right way of understanding Noether's first theorem. If people are interested in further literature on this, I'd be happy to give details. The recent applications of Noether's first theorem in quantum mechanics and electromagnetism, for example, are found in this paper here. These are papers by two philosophers. This is defending the traditional point of view that there's an explanatory asymmetry, that there's something distinguished about the symmetries rather than conservation principles, and this is the defense. What might be called the revisionist account, and also here in this book. Thanks very much.
Is there any physics in this conserved
I don't know.
There should be many conserved quantities very physical.
Yeah. Well, this is why I was posing this little challenge to the quantum information people. We often think intuitively that when something's conserved, that's a materialist issue.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is conserved. It's
why is
the measure of
conserved information?
Why is it
Well, you had some special boundary conditions,
sure.
Maybe they're physically they're never realized.
No, take a spin chain periodic. You don't have any boundary material with that. I mean, there are many systems.
What was the boundary condition? You
the boundary
want
condition
to
is that this tends to zero sufficiently fast as x tends to.
But suppose you have a periodic system, then you don't have a boundary and you have a constant quantity. I mean, and there are many instances where you would. Or we'll take your localized, you know, any localized object.
So would you work on a closed boundary that the result
that the gradient term goes to zero?
No, but there's no boundaries. There's no boundary, you don't have to care about boundary terms. Or if you have a localized object, any lump of energy which is localized here, which it is in any physical system. Which
but you see, what you would like is that the integral of the rotor of B is identically zero. Now, if you have a boundary term into a boundary term.
If there's no boundary,
we don't know that it vanishes.
There's no boundary term, so it vanishes.
Yeah.
The integral of a total derivative is zero.
Well, let's go to the electromagnetic example.
Not just it's
so
the integral of a derivative.
The integral of the rotor of B in the Hourly space. You want it to vanish so that you can interpret the conservative quantity as the integral of B dx.
Yeah.
But would that be the case of the integral of the rotor?
The integral of a gradient.
It's not a gradient, it's the rotor of
the integral of the curl, or what you call the rotor.
Oh, I see.
The integral of the total derivative is zero.
Oh, I see. Right.
It's equal to the curl of B times dn, where dn is the normal to the surface.
Right.
Now, if B tends to zero fast enough, the distance, then that surface term will vanish, but otherwise it won't. You do have to put in a boundary condition to make that surface term vanish.
No, I'm also suggesting if there is now no boundary, then that integral has to be zero.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
You have a boundary integral, there's no integral at zero. So if it's a periodic system. I mean, I'm just saying, and in many instances for physical systems, this is what happens. But if you have a localized, if you have an infinite system and you want, you know, finite energy, you want things localized inside. It's not uncommon, it's a very natural condition. But the question is whether it's improved. Or if you take for wave functions which are analytic, like coherent states, or you can take a curve in complex plane, which have no boundaries, and then you get some. And this one, we might be corresponds to the number of turning point of the wave function. So there are topological environments that you usually, I don't know, identify as something that comes in. That's an interesting question.
I mean, in a sense, insofar as it's a little challenge to the quantum information, for people who believe the wave function is purely information. I mean, really, in a sense, the challenge is already here. Why should a system that you're not looking at, that you're not measuring, that you're not prodding, and you're not probing, why should it evolve in a very non-trivial way? If it happens to reflect simply my ignorance or my information, and I go to sleep and nothing changes, I don't get any information, I don't lose any, why does the wave function evolve? And this just brings out some aspect of that evolution.
Actually, if it's a boundary condition, maybe that could be realized trivially, like that actually the interview. If you have psi squared, then it's always positive, but if you have just...
Yeah, it could be that it is zero, but it could be that... You have very boundary condition, this game will count the number of... It will affect the theta term. So suppose the... So when you have a... You will count something like the Aaron of Bohm phase,
we'll
be sensitive to such object.
But normally we assume the wave function is single value.
Yeah, the wave function is single value. So then, okay, so if it's periodic, then. And then this will be trivial.
If you separate that into sort of real elements and imaginary parts, so just choose arbitrarily one of them. Couldn't you try and construct some trajectories for particle positions, construct an explicit model of a Bohm and see what comes out?
What are the implications of the Bohm theory of this?
But it's sharing your equation on a free path. So it's a free path field on the circle. So then we could just sign.
If it's free, yeah. If you have nodes, if you have a non-trivial effect.
Yeah, but there's no potential. Then you know that will change the derivations.
No,
it doesn't change.
No, this derivation doesn't work. Because first of all, it doesn't form. It's not a continuity equation. So it's not corresponding symmetries. I mean, this is very very specific to the free Schrodinger equation.
But then there's a danger, it's kind of trivial. You have to compute it in. Well, it's just, yeah, it's only compute.
Thanks.